Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 128 of The Bugle, the universe's greatest thing of all time.
Wow.
Subject to independent confirmation. For the week beginning, what's that day that kicks the week off? Monday? The 27th of September, 2010, with me, Andy, the blooded fang of truth, Zaltzman, here in the city that might so easily have been called Laundra if Napoleon hadn't been so obsessed with trying on hats and foolishly invading Russia. And joining me live from the city where it all began, and yep. By all I mean the Major League Baseball career of ex-Yankees reserve pitcher Colter Bean, the life of Melanie Griffith, the actress, plankton rights activist, and annual eel crucifier, tougher than it looks, but what a way to celebrate Easter. Also the plot of the hit children's book Derek the Magic Turtle wakes up hungover in New York City. And also, where it all began was the afterlife of the 19th century industrialist Cornelius H. Delameter, who popped his industrial clogs in the Big Apple and was buried in the Bronx, although he currently spends most of his time haunting the former East German athlete Heike Dressler, for no other reason than he is bored of being dead and always preferred Jackie Joyner-Kersee as a heptathlete. In other words, that's a long way of saying, in New York City, it's John, the leaking hosepipe of vengeance, Oliver.
Hello, Andy.
Hello.
Hello, Buglers. Andy, I did a benefit gig this week for a charity that provides guide dogs for the blind. And it's a great charity and a very worthy cause. But an unexpected side effect of this gig was that the entire front row was dogs, Andy. Very unimpressed-looking dogs. They were training them, and they wanted to test how distracted they were. And I have to say, all the dogs did very well, because if they were aiming to give off an aura of complete contempt, then mission very much accomplished for those f***ing dogs. It was like a very strange dream. I wouldn't have been remotely surprised if one of the dogs had looked up at one point and said out loud, "You are just terrible." Can you not do something about how the base of lampposts always smells fantastic? I mean, come on, this stuff writes itself. Some of the very young puppies that were being trained were there as well, yeah. And one of them started yapping a bit towards the end, yeah. And was taken away by a handler who said to me, "Sorry, I think she's just had enough." I don't doubt that, Andy. I don't doubt that at all, but it was all I could do to not zing the shit out of that puppy. "Hey, dog, I don't come down to where you work and interrupt you leading your owner across a busy intersection. Boom! Sit down! Roll over! Stay! Hey, dog, here's a treat. Now give me a paw and get the f*** out of here! Boom!"
Well, I think there might be a reason for this, John, that, of course, they're probably, gone there having heard the Bugle and expecting you to do a load of dog puns, as we did when we covered the Lou Reed dog concert story.
Right,
well, I say I.
Yes. Yeah, don't pull me
into
this.
Well, I was disappointed that it was you, not me, on the bill. So none of them really loved it and threw their leads on the stage at you or anything like
not
that?
Not big fans. No. Not big fans of those guide dogs, no.
That's a shame, because that's a valuable demographic if you
well,
can tap
huge.
Into it.
That's why I took the gig, Andy. I'm not stupid.
So this is a Bugle for the week beginning Monday, the 27th of September, which means it is exactly 420 years to the second since Pope Urban VII set a new world record that still stands to this day by ceasing to be Pope after only 13 days due to a serious and untreatable case of death. His last words were, "13 days, beat that, suckers, a record is a record." Although his hindsight, I wish I'd gone for most chocolate biscuits eaten in 25 minutes instead of shortest Pope reign, or even loudest underarm squelchy by a major religious leader. Still, I'm in the books. And as Christina Aguilera herself once wrote, "'Tis better to have been Pope for 13 days and died than never to have been Pope at all." Bugle 128, John. That's...
Yep.
I mean, it doesn't get much more momentous than this. We've made it. We have now done enough full Bugles to do a complete Wimbledon-style seven-round straight knockout to find the best ever Bugle.
Wow.
We have the full singles draw. Bound to be some upsets in the first couple of rounds. But you'd expect by the quarterfinals, some of the top Bugles will be duking it out for the £1.2 million prize and the chance to grope the Duchess of Kent on the arse. Which is an option that few Wimbledon champions ever take up, despite it being written into the bylaws of the All England Club. That's why the Duchess of Kent always looks slightly disappointed at the awards ceremony. She's been watching the men's final with an inflated whoopee cushion in her underpants for the last 30 years, waiting to pull off the ultimate prank. So what's this issue going to be, John? Issue 120. Is it going to be a Roger Federer, a Martina Navratilova? Or is it going to be an Alex Bogdanovich? Or maybe a Jill Hetherington? That is a reference for fans of largely unsuccessful late 1980s Canadian women's tennis players. Three Wimbledons, three first-round losses. Tough luck, Jill. That'll teach you to secretly fund and arm the Mujahideen. Oh, no, hang on, that was the CIA. Oh, well, no smoke without fire. See you in The Hague, Hetherington. Sue us if it isn't true. And, as always, some sections of the Bugle going straight in the bin. Monday, the 27th of September, is, and you don't need me to tell you this, I'm sure, UN World Tourism Day. So we have a special tourism section. If you're listening to this on holiday, well done. You are supporting the good works of the UN. If you're not on holiday, f*** you. You oppose everything the United Nations does, including its work to help children, the poor, the starving, refugees, the disenfranchised, ill people, people who don't want the world to explode, and also their efforts to bring war criminals to justice. You are opposed to all of those things. But to commemorate World Tourism Day, tourism section in the bin, including how to go on holiday and have fun without being arrested, imprisoned and executed. Step one, don't try to smuggle drugs through Southeast Asia, no matter how much your buddies tease you for chickening out.
Good advice.
And step two, don't have a hen party in Saudi Arabia.
Again, good advice.
Also, I speak from bitter experience. Also, what a previous life that was. Also, we clarify the often confusing fine line between tourism and invasion, often a basic question of the size of your tour group and the weaponry at its disposal. Plus, this year's must-go-to holiday destination, it's Joe Biden's swimming pool. We tell you how to talk your way into the Biden family home and quietly set up camp by their pool without attracting the attention of the VP's security detail. That's in the bin.
Top story this week, give me a U. Give me an N. Give me an annual gathering of diplomats and heads of state. What have you got? The UN General Assembly! Just yesterday...
You've been doing too many stadium gigs, John.
Just yesterday, Andy, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon launched the 65th UN General Assembly here in New York City. He was picked to host after the controversial hosting job last year of Billy Crystal, where he did a song and dance parody of each member nation in a 13-hour opening monologue that was described as both breathtakingly offensive and mind-blowingly long. Instead, this year, Ban Ki-moon stuck to his more traditional approach, running on stage to the sounds of Two Unlimited's You're Ready For This, before sliding on his knees and firing T-shirt cannons into the electrified crowd. The T-shirts had a variety of slogans on, Andy, such as Ban's the Man, Unstoppable Moon, with the un of unstoppable in the UN font, and finally, This Is Where the Assembly Is At, with an arrow pointing toward the groin.
But he's also released his new album, Blue Moon, which is his more risque stand-up.
That's right. That's right. Not for the kiddies. The whole city here, Andy, has been buzzing with anticipation all week, and that's no surprise. It's the most glittering week in global democracy. The paparazzi were out in full force yesterday as the biggest names in politics walked the powder blue carpet. As delegates from all the nations walked past, there was a sea of camera flashes and shouts of, Mr. President! Mr. President, who are you wearing? And what are you going to do about your nation's shameful infant mortality rate? Mr. President! Big smile over here, please! Big smile! In his opening address, Ban Ki-moon said the UN provided a moral compass for a world in which social inequalities were growing, with women and children bearing the brunt, which is true, but the UN has had real trouble with its moral compass in the past, Andy. It's been very unreliable, like when it inexplicably pointed away from Rwanda. Probably just needs shaking up and down a bit or not being stored next to magnets. After Ban Ki-moon had warmed the audience up, Andy, with a bit of crowd work, just basic stuff like what's your name, where'd you come from, why aren't you doing more to increase literacy in your region, can I count on your support in reducing carbon by 2025, is that your tie or did your neck just throw up, that kind of thing.
Where's that from? That's nice.
He handed the mic over to President Obama, whose speech focused mainly on the Middle East peace process, including a plea for unity, and for all nations to present a united front supporting a peaceful resolution, featuring cutaway shots of the Palestinian delegation and then the Israeli delegation's empty chairs, because Israel, Andy, did not turn up. Now, you might well ask, How could they not turn up to the most important speech on the future of their region in years? They must have had an excellent excuse. Well, it turns out that they were at home observing the Jewish holiday of Sukkot. And the day went... And exactly, the fact it went quiet rather than, oh yes, of course, down the other end of that microphone.
I was just observing it myself. F*** you, John.
It's the day, of course, as we all know, especially you, Andy, when Jews build makeshift huts called sukkahs from leaves and twigs.
They're called Wendy houses.
No. From leaves and twigs to commemorate the fragile dwellings they lived in when the ancient Israelites wandered the desert. Which makes perfect sense, Andy. You can now totally understand why they couldn't make the UN General Assembly now. As holidays go, that's a biggie. It's not like Jews have lots of holidays. Do you not think that God might have given them a mulligan on this one, Andy? Surely he'd let this one slide considering what was on the line. He's not going to be up in heaven saying, congratulations, you've brought peace to a region beset by war. May you live in harmony for... Hold on a second. Where's your grass hut? Oh, I know you didn't just skip Sukkot. I know you didn't do that. You know what a stickler I am for that holiday of the hut. That's it. Famine and pestilence be upon all of you. Seriously. Famine and pestilence for everyone. I'm so pissed off right now.
Yeah, Obama called for guess what in the Middle East. We'll give you a multiple choice. Was it A, free tricycles for all? B, more food fights, less gunfights? C, peace? Or D, more strip clubs? Well, it was, of course, C, explicitly, and B, implicitly, possibly with A as an incentive, and D as an inevitable upshot of increased westernisation.
Oh, very good.
And he also, he's apparently trying the carrot and stick approach with Iran, John.
Right.
And it's all very well, but of course there's a problem with the carrot and stick approach, as we well know, and that is if you get a big enough carrot, you can't actually use it as a stick.
Yes.
And if you actually get some of those little carrots and coat them in lead, you can sort of use them as little makeshift bullets. So in many ways, the carrot is in fact much more dangerous than the stick.
It is true.
And there you go. That's a bit of classic... Zaltzman and Oliver from 2004, I believe. I think it was 2004.
Could be.
Yeah, classic stuff.
I think it's Zoliver 2004.
Yeah.
It might seem strange to have Obama as your opening act for the Assembly, but the truth is the big speakers are traditionally the whack jobs of the UN. They're the big ticket acts who can forget Chavez claiming that the room still smelt of sulphur after the presence of George W. Bush, or Colonel Gaddafi talking for so long last year that he went through two translators. All special moments. Someone who's been consistent, though, when it comes to producing the consistent crazy over the years is Ahmadinejad. And he did not leave his fans disappointed this year by going on a rant about 9/11, saying there was an argument that some segments within the US government orchestrated the attack to reverse the declining American economy and its grip on the Middle East in order to save the Zionist regime. At this point, the American delegation walked out. He then went on, the majority of the American people, as well as most nations and politicians around the world, agree with this view. And at this point, lots of other delegations walked out as well. It was like everyone was just going through the motions. They walk out every year. It clearly isn't stopping him. They're handling him all wrong, Andy. The way I see it, they have three key options. Either everyone should walk out, and I mean everyone, including cameramen and translators, leaving him talking awkwardly to a completely empty room, or you should stay all the way through it. Don't give him the satisfaction of a dramatic walkout. Instead, read a book while he's sitting there. Play a board game with nearby delegates. Get out an inflatable neck pillow and take a nap. Or better still, order a pizza to the UN chamber and munch on it while he's talking. Give him the respect he deserves. Or they should just electrify the podium. And every time someone says something crazy, a 100-volt jot should be shot through it. I think that might gradually teach the extremist leader of the world to be slightly less moronic. But it wasn't just 9/11 conspiracy spewing from Ahmadinejad. He also took a hard line on nuclear weapons, but perhaps not the hard line everyone was expecting. First, he referred to nuclear energy as a heavenly gift, which is simply scientifically untrue, Andy. It is very much a manly gift, nuclear energy. A gift from mankind that I think we all wish we'd rather never opened. He apparently also criticised the US for not dismantling its nuclear weapons and then claimed that he was reiterating his call for a nuclear-free world. He said, the nuclear bomb is the worst inhumane weapon and which must be totally eliminated. I do hope that he winked at the camera after that, Andy, and then said, seriously, no one should ever have nuclear weapons, and then winked again.
John, clearly, he really wants to lead the world in nuclear disarmament, and in order to be able to do that, he has to have some nukes to disarm.
Yeah, I suppose that's
so
it.
This is a lot. It's the most pacifist nuclear weapons program in the history of humanity.
He's branched out his irritation this year because he even caused trouble before getting into the chamber. Apparently, hotel guests in the hotel in Manhattan where he's staying complained that he bought a personal chef to prepare his food for him that made, and I quote, the whole hotel stink like hell. Now, that's a bit unfair to the chef, Andy, because on that particular day, Ahmadinejad had ordered takeout from Thank Allah It's Fridays, which is his favourite restaurant. Their infidel burger is a classic, Andy. Like the slogan says, it stinks like hell, but it tastes like heaven. This might be the biggest insult of all from Mahmood. Who brings a chef to New York City, Andy? This is one of the most consistently delicious cities in the world. Maybe he just needs to have one meal here, because I'm pretty sure his attitude to America would change before the dessert menu came out.
Particularly if he went to Katz's Deli.
Yeah, oh, you can't argue with that.
I don't want to plug places that aren't giving us money. But
he'd become a of a lot less anti-Semitic after one sandwich there.
Absolutely. The UN also have discussed their Millennium Development Goals that were set at the start of the millennium to be achieved by 2015. As yet, none of those goals have been scored. It does appear at times that the UN is playing for a 0-0 draw. Some politicians do claim they're still on target, and that come 2015, all the world will be able to hear is the UN's commentator getting increasingly excited in his commentary box, shouting, chance to eradicate poverty and hunger, false Nazi for the developed world, shoots, goal! Universal primary education now, clean through, just to keep it to beat, goal! Reducing child mortality, unmarked to the far post, free header, oh, hit the post, rebound, goal! Combating AIDS, back to combat. Malaria, back to AIDS, dink through for malaria, goal! What a performance of the developed world. It's an absolute millennium goals feast. Yeah, because a lot of people think that we're not quite on track. We've been sidetracked by other issues, such as forking out f***ing trillions of dollars to clear up the economic excrement crap through the world's letterbox by the risk-taking shitbags of the financial sector. And also by just not being quite asked enough about it. And these goals might not be met. UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon encouraged world leaders not to abandon their targets and not to balance budgets on the backs of the world's poor. And a number of world leaders responded, oh, but we like balancing budgets on the backs of the world's poor. It's fun, and they've got really balancy backs too. Nice and flat, ideal for budgets. It's all too reminiscent of the last millennium, John, when the Millennium Development Goals then weren't met 1,000 years ago. They included learning how to ride a pig, wondering what berries you're allowed to eat without dying, and wondering why the f*** everyone was living in mud huts and grunting when 1,400 years previously the Greeks had been inventing democracy, building the Acropolis and oiling up teenage boys and making them wrestle. For their own physical development, of course.
Great Britain update now! And, well, Great Britain may be forced to officially rename herself Great Britain after a series of damning reports came out this week. The most eye-catching of which is that the British Isles are reportedly the worst place to live in Europe. Yes, that's right, that Europe, the first one you thought of then, the one with Poland and Romania in it, as well as Greece, which is technically bankrupt. Apparently, Britain is worse than all those places, due to the fact that British residents endure higher prices, work harder and receive poorer public service than anyone else on the continent. Ouch, Andy. That is a bad review. If that was on hotels.com, no one would ever stay in Britain ever again.
Well, that clearly isn't happening, John.
Oh.
In fact, I think it was a table of the top 10 European economies, so right. I think this might be an overexcited sub-editor writing a false headline. I'm sure that would never happen in a British newspaper. The UK came second worst and Ireland was worst. But I do hope, I think we can take some credit for Ireland coming last.
I was going to say.
Oh no, still. We pay more for food, fuels and magazine about men's health. We spend more time in the office working or pretending to work. and spend less time in the sunshine, which is not entirely our fault. That's partly the sunshine's fault. Funding for health and education is lower than elsewhere, and we work until we're more nearly dead than everywhere else, and we don't go on holiday as much. Which basically means, John, that we are a bunch of miserable c***s.
Someone connected to the survey said, last year, compared with our European neighbours, we were miserable but rich. This year, we're miserable and poor. OK, so at least it seems that our misery is stable, Andy. It's just our economy which is fluctuating.
You just worry that if the government balances the economy out, we're just going to... It's gonna have violent mood swings. It's so hard to get them both stable at the same time.
We could become bipolar as a nation rather than just stuck in our morass of a funk. The leader of the Quality of Life Index were France and Spain, as workers there have more paid holidays, earlier retirement, lower prices, longer life expectancy, and more sunshine. There's that sunshine again, Andy. Is that our problem? Should we just install a tanning lamp in the sky above Britain? Would that make everyone feel better? But maybe we should just calm down collectively. We've always found France's long lunches and Spain being asleep for half the afternoon hilarious. But to be honest, we're no closer to regaining our empire than they are right now. They just gave up quicker. And perhaps they were right to do that. This is our retirement as an empire. We shouldn't be running around and working. We should be doing a spot of gardening, finding ourselves a hobby, and going lawn bowling with other washed-up nations.
And as if to back up this survey, a report has come out suggesting that the police in Britain have lost control of the streets of this nation, and that there are an estimated 14 million incidents of antisocial behaviour every year. That is one every 2 seconds across the country. That's an estimated 14 million incidents of antisocial behaviour, and only 5.3 million of those are in the audience at the Manchester Comedy Store.
still stings, yeah, doesn't it, Andy?
It's just one weekend of gigs 8 years ago, but still, the point stands. Alternative versions of that joke, 14 million incidents of antisocial behaviour a year, and bear in mind those figures for the year 2009 included the 7,230 times that Gordon Brown tried to talk to someone. Bang! That's not including Tony Blair starting all those wars. Bang! That does include 13.9 million cases of people eating raw garlic on public transport. Tough crowd, including an average of 500,000 people a year dying. Doesn't get more antisocial than that in my book. Really puts a damper on a karaoke night, as Elvis Presley's friends would testify. 14 million antisocial behaviour incidents. At least that's gone down since Henry VIII stopped decapitating all those wives of his. Boom! I'm done.
Around 45% of calls to the police in Britain relate to antisocial behaviour. And there was an old lady on the news saying, they stick their arse on my window and they think it's funny, but it's not. It's not funny. Well, the problem is that it is, Andy. It is funny. I mean, it's awful and they shouldn't do it. And I'm sure it's horrible that it happens and it should stop. But secondhand, when the old lady describes it, it is funny. That's important to state.
I'm sure she'll come to appreciate that.
Yeah. Police have been told to reclaim some neighbourhoods. And when you start reading about this, it sounds increasingly like Afghanistan. In fact, if you substituted Al-Qaeda and insurgents for hooligans and yobs, Afghanistan would start sounding like Britain. Maybe Britain should just give up on antisocial behaviour as well as our empire as well, and just start to accept that we're going to be run by gangs of marauding children. We can become Lord of the Flies, Andy. We just need to warn any tourist that you cannot speak without holding the conch shell. And if you see someone looking for their glasses, ignore them.
But do you know why this is happening, John?
Why?
It's because the CIA was secretly funding and arming British children throughout the 1980s. So what defines antisocial in this antisocial behaviour? Well, according to the Crime and Disorder Act of 1998, it is acting in a manner that caused or was likely to cause harassment, alarm or distress to one or more persons. Mm-hmm. Which, coincidentally, is also a direct quote from a review of your first Edinburgh show, John.
I thought it rung a bell.
So looking at these figures, John, I guess the question that raises its pimply head is, has Britain simply become a nation of irritating little pricks? And I guess the answer is yes. Is that why you left, John? Just to get away from people being so antisocial?
Yeah, but I was just fed up of being bullied by 10-year-olds.
So, in response to this, and warnings that the police need to get a control of it, and that they've become too obsessed with chasing crime statistics and targets and have ignored antisocial behaviour. The government's current policy is to slash the budget for the police and the legal system. Bingo! Treble f***ing 20. Home run! Which is, incidentally, what you already have to do to get back to your house in some parts of this country after 6pm. So what is the rationale behind this total bunch of cuts that the government are imposing? Well, I guess, John, they've looked at the crime figures and the hugely complex social problems behind them, and they've thought, ah, got to do the cuts. Got to cut them cutty cuts. All about the cuts. That deficit going to eat you up. Num, 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 num. Cut, cut, cut. Cutty, cutty, cut. Here, cutty, cutty, cut. Bowl of milk for the little cut. Ah, no milk for the cut. Naughty cut. Find your own milk. Cut this. Yeah, cut that. Why not cut my arm, own arm off? In for a penny. Someone in the private sector will stop the bleeding. That is inevitable. And if we don't cut, tick, tick, boom. If I may quote George Osborne yesterday in an official statement. But seriously, could cutting police and court funding really help bring crime and antisocial behaviour statistics down? Well, of course not. But on the other hand, cut, 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 cut. There you go. Pope update now, and, well, would you believe it? We let him slip.
He got away, Andy. What did he do? Say, look over there, a miracle, oh, and then run away.
I think so. We took our eyes off the old codger for half a second and zip, he'd gone. Before we could even get him to sign a couple of T-shirts to go in the British Museum. It's so much harder to steal artefacts these days, so you have to get him where you can.
But. Or did you just grab hold of him and then he slipped out of his robes and ran naked down the street?
I think he did that as well. I think it's on YouTube. Before we could even get him to a guest spot on a topical quiz show or come on the Bugle or testify in a court of law. None of those things. He gave us the slip, the crafty little nugget, and Pope right back off to his Vatican HQ where, as we speak, I imagine he's just popped out down the road for a phenomenal steak at the Dal Toscano restaurant. Man, that place knows what to do with meat and when to do it. Lunchtime and supper time and in between if you're still hungry. I digress. But the Pope is out there. He's right out there. Before he left these shores, he did say a couple of slightly odd things, including it seemed blaming Nazi atrocities on the fact that they were atheists, rather than the fact that they were Nazis, or even the fact that they were but it's all to do with atheism. But nevertheless, did do a couple of classic bits of popery, including beatifying the skiffle musician.
is that a nice-smelling act, Sammy?
Yeah, it is. That's where it comes from. Yeah, from, I believe it was Pope Eucalypt II, who used to bless all toilets in the Vatican.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Anyway, he beatified the British skiffle musician Lonnie Donegan. The citation from the Vatican read, although Donegan did not, it would appear, perform any verifiable miracles per se, he certainly knew one end of a catchy tune from the other, and with 24 consecutive top 30 hits, he is, to all intents and purposes, the patron saint of skiffle. We are merely in the process of formalising that position. He departed by having a sideswipe at the roof inside Westminster Abbey, saying, call that a ceiling. You should see the one I've got back home in my special chapel. Suckers. Brightly coloured. All action. It's like a kid's cartoon, but with more willies. He, that's what you never hear in a guidebook about Michelangelo.
True. It's true, Andy.
He also played down the controversy over child abuse in the Catholic Church, saying, it was ages ago, and if you think that was bad, you should see what Stalin did in Russia. Your emails now, and this one comes in on the subject, The Suspense is Killing Me. Dear Andy and John, as the weeks have passed since the Edinburgh Fringe came to an end, I, like undoubtedly many of the other buglers who did not make it to Andy's show, have been waiting in a state of fatalistic terror for Andy's promised wrath to strike. I am now in a state of almost unbearable nervous tension, waiting for the mailed fist of implacable Zoltzmanic vengeance to crush me from existence like a bug. If you could give me some hint of when I should expect my deserved annihilation, it would really help with my day-to-day planning.
That's reasonable.
I've obviously made sure that my will is in order, but should I, for example, tell my boss to shove his poxy job where the sun don't shine and enjoy my last few days in a frenzy of hedonistic excess? Or might I instead expect to see my first grandchild born? Is Andy working to some sort of geographically based retribution planning regime so that those of us in New Zealand get a slight reprieve over those listeners in locations less distant from the epicentre of Andy's righteous crusade for justified revenge? Any information you could supply would be appreciated. Yours in dread but resigned anticipation, Stephen Harvey in Wellington, New Zealand.
What? That's, I think those Australia. Are all good questions. Those are fair questions. Those are fair questions, Andy.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, Stephen, and thanks very much for bringing this up, because it is quite hard for me to talk about, is that having promised this deadly vengeance, it has run into, I guess, what you'd call a number of legal difficulties regarding slaughtering Bugle listeners who did not come to my Edinburgh show, which appears to be somewhat outside the bounds of legality in most Bugle listening countries, other than some of the really extreme ones. I know that any female buglers in Saudi Arabia are basically fair game, but apart from that, it is proving to be difficult. So I guess I'll just have to wait until the world swings hard right, which I reckon should happen in about 15 years after a massive economic crash and a global drought and starvation.
Okay, so it's you got 15 years until Andy's consequence-free rampage.
But I would, anyway, tell your boss to shove his poxy job where the sun don't shine, which I did once in the one time I had a proper job, and not in those exact words, but I think the message was clear from the rapidity with which I resigned. And it's a hugely liberating experience, I can tell you that for free.
It's an email from Alan Trotter now. He said, "Dear John, Chris and Andy, in order of profitability to Penguin Books." Sorry, Andy, but as far as I'm aware, Chris has never published with one of our competitors. "I work in the marketing department of Penguin and I'm slightly concerned at how long it's been since John mentioned The Daily Show and John Stewart present Earth the Book on the podcast. As the 15th listed author on the title page and therefore I assume the most important, you are right. I would think you'd be constantly bringing up this hilarious, fully illustrated, irreverent 250-page guide to our planet. It's certainly full of more than enough bullshit to appeal to the average Bugle listener. So if you could try and mention it as many times as possible in the next few shows, that would be very much appreciated. Perhaps Chris, the producer, could be renamed The Daily Show and John Stewart Present Earth, the book now available from all good bookshops, The Producer, just for the next month or so." Well, yours commercially, Alan. Well... Well, Alan, I haven't mentioned it much, partly because the pain of squeezing that book out has not fully left me yet, even though it has been published. I think we're all still in shell shock for just how rough it was to get it finished. But you're right, it's out now, and in fact, John Stewart went on Oprah this week, so I believe it's the biggest selling, it's the highest selling book on Amazon, because you get dusted with Oprah's... book magic. If you go on Oprah and you mention a book, Andy, that book becomes the best-selling book in the world.
That's maybe where I went wrong with my book.
You should have gone on Oprah. Well, I don't understand why you didn't do it.
Yeah.
It makes such obvious sense.
Yeah.
You'll know for next time, Andy.
I will know for next time.
I think the incentives to read it out are a little thin.
Yeah.
Because I work on another radio show where just for a brief mention of a chocolate bar, I've got a year's supply of whispers. And here I'm getting asked to change my name to something I can't even remember. That's to true. Promote your work, John.
That's just true.
You seem a bit more keen to plug this book than you are to plug your film, John. Why that is.
Yeah. Neither do I, Andy.
Did you give the subject of the email, the biggest publishing sensation since the novelisation of The Love Guru?
No.
I think you skipped over that, didn't you?
I skipped over that. Yeah.
was that film on Oprah as well or not?
I think that was the problem.
Yeah.
I think had that film been on Oprah, it would have been the most successful film of all time. It would have destroyed Avatar's records.
Yep. That's the only thing that was wrong with it.
That is literally the single problem with that movie.
Sport! And, well, the big news in sports, John, as I'm sure it has been in America, is the unfolding chaos ahead of the Commonwealth Games in Delhi.
Andy, are America involved? Are American athletes involved in the Commonwealth Games? If the answer is no, they couldn't give a shit, Andy.
Well, they could have been, John.
Yep, you know,
they
true.
They used to be part of the Empire.
They chose
they
not to be.
Could have been part of the Commonwealth.
They chose not to be, yeah.
It turns out that the athletes' village is, quotes, parts of the athletes' village, quotes, not fit for human habitation.
Uh-oh.
And I guess the organisers' response would be, these are professional athletes, they're supposed to be superhuman.
True.
So they should be able to cope with the odd cockroach here and there. There have been bridges and roofs collapsing, and the response to that has been, they look better on the ground anyway. And in response to facilities not being ready, the organisers said, come on, it's only sport, lighten up everyone. And the threat of dengue fever... Apparently it's mostly non-fatal. So there we go. I think it's all going to be fine.
Okay,
it's all
going to
be fine.
That's
it's just
fine.
A big sports day anyway. The Egg and Spoon Stadium is not going to be fit for the start of the games, though. They're going to have to hold it in the cricket ground, I think. Also, next weekend, the Ryder Cup begins and ends, in fact. begins on Friday, ends on Sunday. I'm going to be there on the Sunday, which should be an absolute hoot.
Oh, that's so, pretty cool.
Do look out for me on the telly, dressed up as a table dancer trying to distract Tiger Woods.
He'll be the one throwing himself in front of a drive from the American team, screaming, "No!"
So it's the two greatest countries in the world of golf, John, America and the nation of Europe, going head-to-head, three iron to three iron, unflattering trouser to unflattering trouser, miserable face to miserable face, and needless complaint about someone taking a photograph on their backswing to needless complaint about someone insulting their mother in an outbreak of jingoistic overexcitement. So who's going to win? I guess that depends on what happens, so I can't tell you. But it's safe to
that
say.
Is a very rational response.
Safe to say there's going to be a lot of golf balls hit with a lot of golf clubs on that golf course.
Yep.
A lot of great golf shots played on some great golf holes, and a lot of golf wives dressed in matching golf wife blouses and golf wife skirts, knowing their golf place in the golf scheme of golf things. And second, I'll look at key players. We did Jim Furyk the other week. This week, Europe's Martin Kamer, the winner of the recent US PGA tournament. He's so committed to his golf game, John, that Kamer will only date women with dimply faces that remind him of golf balls. He first realised he might be good at golf at a picnic when he was 5 years old, when he swatted a fly off a tomato with a baguette. The German warms up before each round by getting out a ghetto blaster in the clubhouse, putting his special tape in, and singing and dancing to the backing to a backing track of the 70s disco classic YMCA, with the letters altered to G-O-L-F. It's fun to play G-O-L-F. To motivate himself, whenever he shoots a bogey, he boos himself all the way up the next hole. If he shoots another one, he starts chucking in some verbal abuse at himself on the next tee. And if he bogeys three in a row, he starts punching himself in the face and wrestling himself to the ground before pulling himself away from himself and telling himself to grow up and focus on their golf. Could be the key man.
It's going to be a fascinating weekend, isn't it, Andy?
Well, that's the Bugle forecast. Who is going to win the Ryder Cup, John?
Golf will win, Andy, yet again.
That's the important thing, yeah.
Golf will be the winner.
It hasn't always won at the Ryder Cup, to be fair.
It has not, no.
Bickering and bad sportsmanship has won, yeah. On occasion. This, I do like the Ryder Cup, because it always reminds me roughly when my wedding anniversary is. Every other year.
Well, that's useful.
Well, that's it for the Bugle this week. Do keep your emails coming in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
I have nothing else to add. You people are on your own for the next 7 days.
Adieu.